Good evening, everybody. I'm Mike Allison, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February the 12th, 1990, and my home group is the Brentwood Full Moon Group. Brentwood Full Moon Group is meets, that's just south of Nashville, Brentwood is. We meet on Friday nights at 6:30. We've got an open discussion meeting and a newcomers meeting. We also have an open speaker the last meeting of the month. There's an Al-Anon meeting and an Alateen meeting across down the hall from us at the same time, the same location. So if you're ever in the Nashville area, we'd love to have you. It's been a real emotional weekend coming here. Diane and I hadn't been here in about 9 years, and we were asked to speak here in 2005. And I've been reflecting a lot lately about all the people and all the love and support that I've had since I've been sober, and I realized that I didn't really none of the I'm glad for the sobriety I have certainly, but I don't take any credit for it in any way because I had so much love and support from people, and part of that was coming to Mont Eagle and hearing the message of recovery from AA and Al-Anon in this room. There's been a lot of people that have shared, poured their hearts out in this room. And I'm really grateful that I've gotten to be a part of that. And I really like to thank the board for, and everybody that's ever been on the board that's kept this going for so long. I mean, this roundup's been around for a long, long time, and it's helped a lot of people, and it's helped guys like me too. The experience I have, I'm able to bring home to my home group and to the people I associate with in the fellowship, and that's just priceless. AA and Al-Anon never cease to amaze me about the goodness that it brings to all of us. It's truly one of God's greatest gifts. It's the best gift in my life. I owe my life to Alcoholics Anonymous. All I did was come here when I was 39 years old, just a broken person. I was a broken human. I was angry. I was depressed. I had no hope. I was trying to look good on the outside, and I was just rotten on the inside. I didn't want to live another day. It was just another miserable day, one day at a time of existence, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. And AA has given me a chance to be the kind of husband and father and brother and son and grandfather and friend that I always wanted to be, but alcoholism just drugged me to the dark side and prevented me from doing all that. So I'm real grateful that AA is here, and thank you so much for the board and for Dirk for inviting us here, and thanks to Jeff for being my host, and for Andrew hosting Diane. Thanks to Kelly for getting us started off last night for a great weekend of recovery. I appreciate your story and your message of hope and how it is to live sober. And I really look forward to hearing. I hadn't heard Marty before, so I'm looking forward to Marty's story tomorrow. And that Al-Anon speaker you had this morning, I like her a lot too. I love my wife, and I love what Al-Anon's done for Diane and our family. And she told me one time, of all the alcoholics and drug addicts she's ever dated, she likes me best. And that's as good as it gets for a guy like me. And before I forget it, I want to thank Scott again for recording this, all the speakers this weekend. I remember when I was new, my sponsor would just hand me cassettes. And I don't remember him asking me, would you like to listen to this? It was like, listen to this. And it was a voice louder than my head. And I had this grand central head to start with. I had all these voices that would start talking to me. I mean, anytime I wanted group therapy, I'd just go for a ride in a car by myself. And all these people would start talking to me, tell me I'm a loser and I'll never make it. And you don't really belong here and blah, blah, blah. And speaker tapes have always helped me. And I've realized that a lot of that's changing. The technology of that is changing. I know people can just can download speaker talks on the internet now for nothing. But Scott takes, and other people that do this, take a lot of time and expense and come and record these things. And if we don't buy their CDs when they're here, they're not going to come at some point in time. And then all those people that I listen to, there's so many people that I've listened that were at this roundup and other roundups that are not around anymore, those people's recordings are still there for us to grow from. And so I really appreciate you doing this. It's a wonderful service. Thank you very much. Like I said, I came here, I was 39. Some people think that if they're going to get sober, they might die. I really thought I might not die. I might live another 39 years just as miserable as I was at the time. I didn't know what was wrong with me. I started out in a family where my parents drank. They started a business about the time I was born, and they'd work hard, and then they'd come home, and they'd drink at night, and then they'd drink on the weekends with their friends. And I thought, you know, this is what you do. You work hard, and then you do this drinking thing and unwind and have fun. But, you know, every now and then somebody would drink a little too much and overshoot the mark, and bad things would happen. And I remember thinking, well, they just drank a little too much. They just need to dial it back a little bit. So when I was like 14 or 15, I went out with some older boys, and I was trying to fit in, and somebody had stolen a pint of Gilby's gin out of somebody's parents' liquor cabinet, and they started passing that around, and they were talking about just how awful it tasted. And I thought it tasted awful too, but I got past that pretty quick. And I'll just cut to the chase. I overshot the mark the first night. I mean, I had a great time, and then I don't remember anything. And I remember these guys taking me home, and I was getting dizzy, and I remember getting in bed, and the bed starts spinning. You know, we're the only ones we put our foot on the floor trying to stop the bed from spinning, like that's really going to work, you know. Well, that didn't work, and I got sick, just horribly sick all over everywhere. I won't go into details about it. And the next morning, I had this horrible hangover, and I remember my mother was talking to one of her friends on the phone and said, you know, Mike was so sick last night, he must have had some kind of virus, so I got away with it too. And not once did I ever think I'm never going to do this again. It's like, I'm not drinking any more gin. Or, I drank too much, before I overshot the mark, everything was great. I was fitting in, and I felt like somebody. It was like filling this hole I had inside of me of being less than. So I spent the next 25 years trying to just not overshoot the mark. It's bad. And if I could drink just enough alcohol, or, you know, I'm an alcoholic, but I like all those party favors that are out there too. So I, as long as I could drink enough and take as many party favors as I could without slurring my words, it seems like I could get along just fine in the world. You know, I was comfortable around people. I could talk to girls. I thought I could dance. I could do a lot of things. But when I was dead sober, I was afraid and had this emptiness inside. And I didn't know I had all those things till I got sober. I really didn't. But alcohol really just fit me like a glove. And so I didn't know it at the time, but I built my life around alcohol from that point forward. And I thought it was quite normal because I hung around people that drank just like I did. So I didn't think it was anything wrong with it. I used to say that my grades went down, but they weren't that good to start with. But my grades went down because school stopped being a priority and partying was the whole thing. As I said, my parents had started a business when I was a kid, so I worked after school in the summer for this family business. And that's the only time I got any self-esteem built up that I thought my dad would appreciate me if I was a hard worker. So I learned to do that. Plus, that gave me the money to lead this lifestyle I was starting to have. So I go off to college. I go to Memphis. I went to Memphis State University, is what it was called at the time, in the late 60s. And that's when the drug culture was taking off, so I started taking these party favors there, and I'm drinking, and I just kind of hung on in there for 4 years. I actually didn't graduate from there. I lacked 6 hours of getting a degree in business management, and I quit because I knew I was going to go work for this family business. I'm a guy I have the best intentions in the world, and I'll start off with the best intentions, then I never would finish anything, and college is one of them. So right before I got out of college, I meet Diane. And we fell madly in love. And I left Memphis State a couple months later and moved back to Nashville, and she quit school in UT Knoxville and moved back, and we're dating, and I go to work for the family business, and I start doing real well at what I was doing. It was a lot of responsibility, and I was energetic and young and ambitious, and working always gave me a sense of that's where my self-esteem was built up, was what I did. So I'm working hard and I'm playing hard, and about a year and a half goes by, I guess it was, maybe a little longer, and Diane and I just weren't getting along. And by the way, I love Al-Anon. Al-Anon's done so much for our family. I mean, Diane and I are really different people in a lot of ways, and there's just some days we're still like oil and water. But with our programs, we've learned to live with each other and to take our own inventory when we get into it and move on. But back then, we didn't have any communication skills, and I just thought she was managing me a little too much. I thought she was going to help me to death at times. And so one day, I just broke it off with her because I didn't know how to tell her anything or discuss it with her. So I broke off with her. And we stayed broken up for about a year, and I had to get my wisdom teeth out. And they said, you know, you got to bring somebody with you because you're going to be a mess. So I get my office manager to come take me to this oral surgeon, and they give me a bunch of drugs in an IV, and I mean, they could have pulled my jawbone out. I wouldn't have cared. And they take my wisdom teeth out, and this guy leads me out to the car, and I'm prancing like a walking horse, and he takes me back to my apartment. He said, look, I got to call somebody. I got to go back to work. He said, you're a mess. Who can I call to look after you till this stuff wears off? And I couldn't talk, but I start writing on this piece of paper. I wrote call Diane and wrote her work number down. And this guy knew that I dated Diane, but he didn't know we'd been broken up for a year. And he just calls her up and said, hey, Diane, this is George, and Mike's had his wisdom teeth out. He wants you to come over to his apartment, take care of him. And she's thinking, George who, Mike who? I mean, she's living with another guy. But she came over on her lunch break, and what they gave me was like truth serum. And I mean, I'm writing, I love you, I want you back, move in with me. And a couple days later, she did. That was March 18th of 1975. We've been together ever since. And every March 18th, we celebrate Tooth Day. And that story's about the drugs I was, the influence of drugs I was under. And again, I'm an alcoholic. I'll take drugs to supercharge my alcoholism or fix it, but I'm an alcoholic. But I'm in my mid-20s at that time, and at this time, I couldn't get past the fear and the pride that I had to tell this woman I really loved her and I wanted her back and I really wanted to try to work this thing out. I couldn't do that unless I was loaded on something. So already, alcohol and drugs had taken over my life by that point in time, and I didn't get sober for another 14 or 15 years, or about 10 years after that. So, but we get back together and we get married a couple months later, and I'm working hard, and my dad leaves the business to take a position that he was offered to be gone for several years. So I take over this business when I'm in my mid-20s. And it was a lot of stress, and it was a lot of work, but I just did it. But I'm working hard, and I'm playing hard, and my drinking and these other stuff that I'm taking is just escalating all the time. And because I was under all this stress, I go to my doctor and I said, look, I got this stressful job, and you know, we had started had two sons, and I said, I got this family, and we got, you know, so he puts me on tranquilizers for that. And so I'm taking the tranquilizers, and then later on I start getting this crippling depression, which I thought I was diagnosed with clinical depression, but I actually know now all I had was untreated alcoholism, which feels the same way. So he put me on antidepressants, and I took those for 9.5 years before I got to AA, by the way, until I found out what was wrong with me. And then I started having these terrible headaches, these migraine headaches. So he gave me a prescription for painkillers for these migraine headaches. So I'm taking these tranquilizers and these antidepressants and these painkillers and all the street drugs I'm taking, and I'm washing all that down with Crown Royal, and I'm just trying to power through life and be somebody. And it just stopped working at some point in time, and it stopped working a long time before I thought it did, frankly. So I started doing some really bizarre things in my early 30s. We live in the same house we've always lived in. We moved there in 1976, and we're up on top of a really high ridge in Nashville. It's one of the highest elevations in the county. It's a long dead-end street, and all our neighbors have really nice view out the back because of the elevation, but most of the people on our street didn't have any landscaping at all in their yards. I mean, they just had their houses in the woods. Well, not me. I was in the landscaping business, and I want to show off what a big shot I was with my landscaping skills, so I'm trying to grow grass in front of my house when we moved there, and had all these trees there, and they'd shade the grass out, and then the leaves would fall and choke it out, and I'd have to rake the leaves. And so one day I thought, well, I'll just cut all my trees down. And that might have been a pretty good idea, but I really wasn't sure exactly where my property line was on one side of me. I knew where it was at the street, but our lot goes way down this steep hill. I mean, We've lived there, you know, 42 years. I've only been down there, down that hill, maybe two or three times because it's almost straight up and down. But I get my plat where I bought my house at a compass, and I go down this hillside, and I find an iron pin in the ground, and I convince myself that that was my boundary. So then I call up a surveyor, and I said, look, I found my property line down on this hillside, but I can't even see my house from where it is. And I said, I want you to mark this for me because I would need my property line marked. And these guys looked at what I told them, these surveyors, and they told me a couple of times, they said, you know, we don't think this is right. But I'm an alcoholic. I got this laser beam focus, man, and I know everything. I know more than a surveyor does, I think. And I'm telling these guys, you know, and I'm paying you, so you do it my way. And I told them that was right, and I wanted them to mark it. You know, I've since found out since I got sober that, you know, if you want a property line found, you can just call a surveyor up and they'll come find the line for you. You don't even have to tell them you know where it is. So they marked this line like I told them to. And when these stakes and flags were coming up the hill up toward our house, when they got there, the stakes and flags were almost touching my next door neighbor's house. I mean, it was from here to that door. And instead of thinking, well, maybe you're wrong, you know, instead, I get really mad saying, well, that old goat, he's been using our property all this time. He built his house up next to the line. He's been using my land. That's what I thought, you know. And so I didn't have any communication skills. I'm not going to wait till this guy gets back from Florida where he is with his wife. I'm cutting these trees down. So I get a buddy of mine who owned a tree surgery company, and he sends two big bucket trucks and all these guys with chainsaws out there, and they cut all these trees down between our houses. And it was a lot of trees, according to a jury of my peers. It was $50,000 worth of trees at the time. That was in 1984. And this man was so upset that he sued me, and he should have sued me. But he was so upset that he asked for a jury trial, which is unusual in a civil case. And so I had to sit through a two-day jury trial. And I remember I dressed up in a three-piece suit. I had a vest with a gold chain and a pocket watch. And I go strutting in this courtroom like I'm some businessman that's been clearly wrongly accused of doing this. And I'd sweat it all the way through the suit. And I was eating these blue Valiums I had during the recesses to seem like I was calm, while his attorney just portrayed me as a lunatic for doing this. And at the end of the 2 days, the jury awarded in his favor, and they gave him the $50,000 that he sued me for, but they added $5,000 more punitive damages to it that he didn't even ask for. Now, if you're new, I'm trying to describe what a resentment is, because I hate this guy for doing this, you know? Because by this time, I'm thinking he's overreacting. I thought they were my trees. You see, I never took responsibility for anything I did. Anytime I was in the wrong, I'd turn it around and make it your fault. I'd just do it instinctively, without thought. Well, so for the next few years, every time I'd see this guy on our street, if he was driving down the street, I'd ease my car over in his lane like I was playing chicken with him. And I'd curse at him when he got his mail. I was just awful to these people. And these were wonderful people. And I'm going to tell you more about Mr. Logan later on. My story is about forgiveness and redemption. And there wasn't anything about that at this point in time. It was just my craziness. And I didn't realize, you know, one of the things I'm so grateful that I become more grateful all the time of the recovery that I've been blessed with is that I look back at this, and it does me a lot of good. I don't like telling all this stuff, but it reminds me of what I drug my family through. And how I never want to be that kind of person again. And if I stay engaged in AA, I've got a shot at not being that person anymore. But, I mean, these are wonderful people. Diane used to take our sons over to their house to visit during the day. And she hadn't been to Al-Anon or didn't know anything about recovery at the time. And after all this blow up when he sued us, she didn't go over there anymore. And I've heard her say in her story that, you know, if I did that today, that she'd stay in contact with these people, that she wouldn't allow my insanity to mess up a relationship they had, but she didn't have those skills at the time either, so I trashed that relationship. And something else I did, I mean, I don't get mad, I get even, or I try to get ahead. And so this man, I was so mad at this man. Several years before I cut his trees down and he sued me. He came to me because he knew I was in the landscaping business. And he said, can you do me a favor? I said, sure, what is it? And he said, well, my wife has always loved weeping cherry trees. Can you get us one of those? I said, sure, I can do that. What else you want? He said, well, I don't know. That's all my wife really wants. I said, well, see if she wants some other shrubbery, I can get that too. And I guess he thought I was trying to sell him something, but I was just trying to be a big shot. So I asked him where he was going to plant the weeping cherry tree and this other things, and he showed me, and I got one of my crews and got the weeping cherry tree and the other plants and went up, sent the crew up there, and they planted the stuff in the man's yard. And he came over to me and he said, I didn't mean for you to plant this stuff. I was hoping you'd just get it for me. He said, how much do I owe you? He just wanted to do business with his neighbor. You know, he's just a kind guy. But see, I remember puffing out my chest and saying, oh, you don't owe me anything. And I was telling him, you know, look at me. I'm a big shot. I got this company. I got these people. You know, thank God y'all are my people today. But I thought, I got these people, and I can just do this, and I don't need your money. So I wouldn't let him pay me. Well, several years later, when I cut his other trees down and he sued me, I went over there the very next night with some herbicide and put on that weeping cherry tree and that other stuff and killed it. Because he hadn't paid me. I can usually tell how many AAs and Al-Anons are in the room, because AAs always go, ha, and the Al-Anons go, ugh. I'm glad you're all here. We're all family. We're all getting well together. And so that's how I was treating my next door neighbor, you know. And about my mid-30s, alcoholism just took me to the dark side. I mean, my life just fell apart. I started cheating on my wife. And I don't like talking about that, but if it, our stories, we've always been open about that. If that's something we can help somebody with to see how we walk through that, that's what we want to share. But I was doing that, and I knew it was wrong, and I had all this guilt and shame and remorse, and I was still doing it. And my father came back, got out of this job he'd had and wanted to come right back into business. And I'd been running it for 4 years. And I let him know that I was in charge now. And he drank like I did, so you can imagine how that went. He'd come out to my office and say he wanted to help me. And he'd come out there and want to tell me what to do. And I was so mad and I couldn't talk to him about it. I brought my shotgun to work one day. I was going to shoot his Buick. I was going to shoot the windows and tires out of his Buick when he pulled in the driveway of the office to let him know I didn't want him around. I mean, I thought that was a good plan that morning. I really did. But I don't know whether God kept me from doing that or I was just afraid of my dad, but I didn't do it. And he asked me, he said, what's your shotgun doing here? And I didn't say anything. Well, I went home and I told Diane what I had planned to do that day. And she said, you know, you need to go see somebody. And for the first time, she didn't try to fix me. So I go to my doctor one more time, and I said, look, I don't know whether you want to put me in a nut house or what, but I was going to assassinate a Buick today, and I know that's not right. And he said, well, go see this lady. And he sent me to a psychologist. And I'd been to counselors of different kinds all my life, off and on, because I just was always just a misfit. And so I decide, I had a Monday morning appointment with this lady, so I decide I'm not going to drink that weekend before I go see her. And every now and then, if I got in too much trouble, got sick, or Diane was on my back, I'd quit drinking. And I actually quit for 8 months one time. And I remember marking on my calendar all the days I hadn't had a drink, and I was everybody's designated driver. And I didn't know anything about AA or recovery, by the way. I just stopped drinking, because I thought if you stop drinking, then everything's fine. Well, I didn't drink for like 8.5 months, and took my brother-in-law's. I was the designated driver in a motorhome up to St. Louis to a baseball game. Of course, it was a guy's trip, so they're all drinking, got a good buzz on before we even got out of Nashville. And we get up to St. Louis, and we check in a hotel, and then they wanted to stop at a bar, get one more drink before we went to the baseball game. And I go in there, and I ordered a Perrier with a twist of lime. By the way, I bought a case of Perrier water to drink on the way up there. You know, you can't just buy one, you got to buy a case. So I ordered this Perrier with a twist of lime, and when the drink came, one of my brother-in-laws had ordered me a Crown on the Rocks. And I had no defense against that first drink. It never occurred to me that I hadn't had a drink in 8.5 months. This is the wrong drink, take it back. I'm not drinking anymore. If I drink this, it won't be the last one. If you drink this, your wife's gonna get mad. I mean, all just like the book said, it was just gone. I had no memory of the bad times of drinking, and I picked the drink up and I drank it, and it was delicious. And I got the waiter over there and I said, bring me another one of these. And he brought me a drink and I drank that and it was great. And I had that sense of ease and comfort that only alcoholics get. I thought everybody got that relief, but they don't. That's why they don't drink. They don't get out of alcohol what I get out of alcohol. It made everything all right, just like that. And I'm thinking, whew, I've had the most miserable 8.5 months of my life. Why in the world was I not drinking? And I got the waiter over and I said, you got any tequila? You got any Cuervo Gold? I hadn't had any tequila in 8 months. You know where this is going. And all of a sudden the bar got quiet. I didn't hear the tinkling glasses or all the people talking. It was just like I was in a vacuum and I was just okay for the first time in a long time. And when that worked for you, that's an attraction that'll kill a guy like me, you know. So we went to the baseball game, and we drank beer and all at the baseball game. And I called Diane about 11:30 that night, told her what a great time I was having. And I thought I'd had a few drinks, and I thought she'd be elated. And there was that pause on the end of the line that I'd heard her one more time. And I got back, and she said, well, if you're going to drink, don't drink around the boys. So I didn't do that. And so I tried some controlled drinking, whatever it is, and you know, it says it's a great obsession that we want to try to control and enjoy our drinking. And my friend David B. back that's in my home group said, you know, you either do one or the other. I can't control and enjoy my drinking. I either control my drinking and don't enjoy it, or I enjoy my drinking and I can't control it. I can never do both. But I tried doing that for the next couple of months, and that's when I got to where I was going to shoot my dad's Buick. So I quit drinking that weekend before I go see this lady, and I go in there on a Monday morning. I'm going to tell her what a rotten guy my father is, and he's on my back, and my wife's on my back, and I got these kids in private schools. We're trying to keep this lifestyle up, and things aren't going well. And the first thing she says is, I want to ask you a few questions. She said, how much do you drink? I said, well, I don't drink. She said, you don't drink at all? I said, no, ma'am. And she said, well, did you ever drink? I said, yeah, I used to. And she said, how long ago did you quit drinking? And I said, Thursday. And really, that was a lie. I looked on my calendar. I actually quit on Friday. I guess I thought if I added a day to it, it sounded like a long time. And I'm telling you, I thought if you're not drinking, then you're okay. And later on, I found out that I really don't have a drinking problem. If I had a drinking problem, all I'd have to do is just stop drinking and my life would be great. But when I stop drinking, my life is a lot worse. Alcoholism is a lot more painful to a guy like me when I'm not drinking because I got nothing to put the fire out. I got nothing. And so she said, well, you know, before you quit drinking, how much did you drink? And I really don't know. I don't know because I had stashes of everything in all my vehicles and where I lived and my work and everywhere. My old friend Tom Reese said I used to clink in the wintertime because I had all these little miniatures of Crown Royal in my pocket, my little men, I called them. So I don't know. I just drank enough. And she said, okay. Yeah. And then she asked me something. It just knocked me to my knees that morning. And thank God I had something, some kind of desperation that hit me at that moment that I held on to. She said, do you take any drugs? And it was like somebody just lifted a rock off of me and the sunlight hit me because I was just tired of living the way I was living. I couldn't live like that anymore. I couldn't live this double life I'd been living all that I didn't even know I was leading. I said, yeah, I take some drugs. And she said, well, what do you take? And I told her all the things I had prescriptions for, and then I told her all the other stuff I was getting from undocumented pharmacists or whatever you want to call them. And then she said, well, do you have any drugs with you now? I said, yeah, I do. And she said, well, what kind of drugs do you have with you right now? And I reached in my pocket and I pulled out my change and I started counting these pills that were just loose in my change. And I had 37 blue Valiums just loose into my change and she thought that was a lot. But I'd quit drinking on Friday and I was a little jumpy, so I bought 100 of them, you know, try to take the edge off, and that's what I had left on Monday. And she stops our interview at that point in time and says, you know, before we go any further, I want you to have an addiction evaluation done. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, I ain't even told you about my father yet. I got real problems here. I mean, I didn't have a clue. So she sends me to another trained professional, and Diane goes with me, and we fill out these questionnaires, and the guy gets us back in the room, and he said, you know, from what you've written down here, He said, by the way, this isn't rocket science. And from what you've written down here, he said, you've been an alcoholic for at least 15 years. And he said, if you don't get some help pretty soon, you're probably going to die from it. And the first thing that goes through my mind is, how could you say it in front of my wife? I mean, not that my life was in grave danger. You know, my ego, it'll kill me trying to protect itself. I mean, I had this giant ego that I just didn't even know I had. And it's still there. It grows back all the time. It has to be smashed. But the guy says, you know, you need to go to treatment. You need to go to AA. I said, man, I'm too busy. He said, what do you mean? I said, I'm too busy. I got this business, and we work outside, and this is wintertime, and it's not doing too well anyway. I got to go to work. He just laughed. He said, man, if you don't do something about your drinking, you don't have to worry about your business. You're going to be dead. And Diane hadn't been to Al-Anon yet. She said, well, how can I help? And the guy said, pack his bags, which that was another resentment I had right at the time. So I said, look, I can't do that. And the guy said, well, you can go to this outpatient treatment place, and you can go at night and you work during the day. So I go see this lady in a treatment center, and in between the time I go from this guy to the lady at the treatment center to talk to her, I'm seeing all these billboards all over Nashville for treatment centers. Seem like they're on every corner. And I start thinking, you know, I'm not that bad. They just know I got good insurance. They're trying to rip me off. I mean, I would go from, I can't stand to live in my skin another 30 seconds to, well, I'm not that bad. And I'd go back and forth like that because I really didn't, I really hadn't hit the bottom of my understanding, I guess. But I see the lady in the treatment center, and she tells me all about her program. I said, this is really good. Really good for you people have this. But I'm busy. I'll come back. I can quit drinking on my own, and I'll come back this fall when I've got more time and do your classes or whatever you're talking about. And she looked at me like I was insane. And she said, just because you quit drinking doesn't mean you're going to quit hurting. And, you know, it took me a long time to figure out what was really wrong with me. And when I was early in sobriety, my sponsor took me to Memphis to hear Clancy. He'd come to talk to the Traditions group. And I have copies of that talk, by the way, that I pulled from a cassette I bought that night that I have on CD. And Clancy said two things that night that told me exactly why I don't belong in AA. He said, the natural state of a sober alcoholic is growing depression and anxiety. When I stop drinking, I get worse, and I have these feelings of anxiety and depression. And he said, and the other thing he said was, the thing that makes alcoholism a fatal illness is that sobriety eventually becomes emotionally unbearable. And that's when I realized I just don't fit in very well in a sober world. I've just never been able to do that without some help. After seeing this lady at the treatment center, I decided I'll go home and I asked Diane, I said, do you think if I do this treatment thing that'll help me with my relationship with my father? And she said, yeah, I think it probably will. Of course, the only reason why I asked her is if it didn't work, I could blame her. But I went to this treatment center, and they said, and I did everything they told me to do. And I thought I was ahead of the curve. I thought, well, I didn't have to go to an inpatient treatment. I'm not that bad. I've nipped this thing in the bud. So I'm really thinking I'm not that bad still. But I had to go to 5 AA meetings a week, and I thought they meant 5 meetings. And they said, no, 5 meetings a week. And I said, man, I'm too busy. And I'm standing up here. I've been sober 28 years and some days, and I average about 5 meetings a week because I got to participate in my own recovery. The longer I'm here, the more I realize I've got to build my life around my sobriety. I don't get to build my sobriety around my life like it's just something I do as a hobby. I just can't do it. I'm glad that I got the 28-year medallion in my pocket, but I don't want to get too many years and not enough days. I mean, this alcoholism is one day at a time. I received some cassettes from John Farrell, who recorded this conference and Semitonga and a couple of other ones a long time ago, and he passed away several years ago. And I got those cassettes back, and I've listened to a lot of them and transcribed some of them. And there were a lot of people on there that I heard their stories years ago, and I know how they turned out, and some of them didn't turn out that good. And so I know I got to stay here. I got to stay here. Because just because I'm up here saying that this is great, this life's good, if I don't continue doing this one day at a time, I may lose this gift I have. Because I don't ever want to do that. It's too precious. So, let's see. Where was I? I decided to go to the treatment center, and they said I had to go to these five meetings, so I found out about the Full Moon Group. And I didn't know anything about AA. I thought it was a couple of old guys in trench coats shaking and puking on each other. You know, I don't know what AA is. And I get dressed up, and I go to the Full Moon Group. I find out about it, and that's still my home group. I pull into the parking lot, and the parking lot's full of cars. And I'm thinking, I've come on the wrong night. You know, there must be some kind of vacation Bible school or picnic or bazaar or something at this church, you know. And I get out of the car, and I start walking across the parking lot, and this guy that's a R&B singer around Nashville is walking across the parking lot. And I recognize the guy because I'd always go see him at the Bluebird Cafe and everywhere else he was playing. And I see him, I'm thinking, you know, this guy can't be an AA. You know, he must be going to do a benefit for this church or belongs here or something. Because I thought he was as whacked out of his mind as I was every time I'd go see him perform. And the guy walks over to me and he said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well, you're so-and-so." And he said, "Yeah." And I introduced myself. I said, "Man, I love your voice and your band." And he said, "Great, I appreciate that." He said, "Can I help you?" And I'm going, "Well, I heard there was an AA meeting here." And he said, "Yeah, mate, you're in the right place." And this guy opened the front door for me for my first meeting. And I went in there and I found out in a little while that he had 4 years of sobriety. He might as well have been Bill Wilson to me. They seemed to know I was new, and they had a first step meeting for me, and I'm so thankful for that because I was such a broken person there. I mean, I was just out of ideas, and AA works a lot better for a guy like me when I'm out of ideas, and I was just out of ideas. And I'm sitting there thinking, well, golly, drinking's not even working for me, and I'm here to say a thing, but the people went around and did a first step meeting for me, and they shared their stories. And one of the guys was there was Joe Wall, who used to come here, and great big tall guy, about 6'6". And he said he'd had two DUIs in one day, twice. And I've never had a DUI. I never got caught. I got out of all of them. So I'm thinking, well, I'm not that bad. And the guy who's now my sponsor, Terry Spencer, was one of the guys that shared. And he said he slept with a pint of vodka every night because he was so physically addicted to alcohol, he had to have a pint of vodka under his pillow. And he said he was down drinking it. He said it was such cheap vodka, there wasn't any vowels in the name. It was all C's and Z's. And he said he'd wake up in the middle of the night shaking, and he'd reach under his pillow and get this pint of vodka out and crack the top and drink about half of it before he'd stop shaking. And he'd put the cap on, put it under his pillow, fall out a couple more hours till the alarm went off, and he'd be shaking again. And he'd finish the pint off where he'd stop shaking enough where he could brush his teeth and shave and put on a tie and go work at this big insurance company. He had a really important job at an insurance company in Nashville. And I'm thinking, well, I'm not that bad. Now, I'm sitting there, I got a loaded 9mm Smith & Wesson pistol in my pocket, and I'm just a dangerous person, and I'm wanting to kill myself and die every day, but I'm thinking I'm not as bad as them. But all the consequences they were talking about, what it was, I didn't connect with, and I want to say that I was different. But all the feelings they had of how painful alcoholism was for them, that's what I connected with, and that they had a way out and that they were doing better than I was. And they all told me to keep coming back, and I hadn't been told to keep coming back in a long time. Actually, when I went around the room, they said, "Do you have anything you want to say?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm Mike. I don't know whether I'm an alcoholic or not. I've been diagnosed with clinical depression," and they all just died laughing. And my grand sponsor said if they'd known I had that pistol in my pocket, they wouldn't laugh at somebody. So be careful who you laugh at. You know? So anyway, I go to AA. I finished this treatment program. It was the first time I ever finished anything in my life. I did everything they told me to do. And I connected with AA, and I loved AA from the start. I know some people don't do that, but I came and I've stayed. And I was learning the lingo, they said I had to get a sponsor to get out of this treatment center the last week before I got out. And so there was a guy in there named Buff that I thought must be president of AA because he said all these good things. And he gave me his phone number the first night. And I thought, well, you know, I'll get Buff to be my sponsor. But I'm real shy and scared, and I don't like rejection or conflict or anything, so I don't ask people direct questions when I'm sober. So I go up to Buff after a meeting one night, and I said, "You know, Buff, I got to get a sponsor before I get out of treatment next week." That was my way of asking him, you know. And he just looked at me and said, "Well, you ought to ask somebody." And he just walked off. So I went to him the next week, and I get to do that now. I like it. And so I went up to him the next meeting. I said, "Will you be my sponsor?" And he said, "Yeah, I'll do that." He said, "I want to tell you something." He said, I'm going to be bone-crushing honest with you, and I want you to be bone-crushing honest with me. I go to a lot of meetings. He said, "And I can't help you a lot with financial romance because I've been bankrupted. I've filed bankruptcy, and I've been divorced twice." He said, "But if you'll take the 12 steps with me like I took them with John Bradford, your life's going to change whether you want it to or not." And that's the best news anybody's ever given me, because it's just true. Everybody that takes the 12 steps, something happens. Something happens. And a lot of times we see the changes before the person does. And so I tried to follow along to start doing what this guy did. And you know, when we're reading how it works, that some of these we balked. I balked at all the steps. Every time I got some relief from taking a step, I'd stop for a while until it got so painful that I either was going to drink again or move on. And so I get the first three steps pretty easy. You know, I really wasn't sure I was powerless over alcohol. I thought I could stop drinking at first, but I know I can't. You know, I realized that incident in St. Louis that I'm not going to have any kind of mental defense against it. And, you know, my hair was unmanageable. My life was a wreck as part of step one, part B. Oh, by the way, when I saw John yesterday, John said, "Golly, where'd your ponytail go?" I thought, "Man, it has been a long time since I've seen you." But anyway, so step two was, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I mean, I knew I was insane. I didn't realize the real insanity is for me to pick up another drink or another drug. I didn't look at it at that point in time. I was just looking at all the craziness that was going on in my life. In making a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, I was just a savage when I came here. I went to church when I was a kid. As soon as I got out of high school, I went to college in Memphis, and I just walked away from all that. And I remember my parents would come visit me in Memphis, and I'd ride them around town, and we'd go by this big cathedral over there by the university. I'd say, "Well, that's why I go to Mass on Sunday. I've never been in that church in my life." And then I came back, and after Diane and I got engaged, a really nice priest counseled us and married us, and I went to church for a while, and I just didn't fit in there. It's nothing to do with the church. I never want to say anything bad about people's religion, because the book said it gives courage and direction to millions, but I just never have connected there for some reason or other. So I left the church again after this priest left, and I was just a savage by the time. I mean, I didn't believe in anything. But I was willing to reach out for that. And Buff said, "Why don't you get on your knees and just ask God to direct your day every morning? And then at night, why don't you get on your knees and just thank Him for keeping you sober today?" And I said, "Okay." A couple days later, he came up to me. He said, "How's that praying going?" I said, "Man, I don't do that stuff. It don't work for me." He said, "What do you got to lose, Hoss?" And I didn't have an answer for him. And I really started getting on my knees and praying in the morning and night just to get my sponsor off my back. But I've been doing that ever since. Something started happening. I started feeling some kind of connection that I can't explain. All of a sudden, in the morning I say the Serenity Prayer and the Third Step Prayer and the Seventh Step Prayer. And I just ask God to direct my day and give me the power to carry out whatever He wants me to do. But as I started praying, I started feeling this power flowing in. All of a sudden my prayers got longer, more eloquent. And I was laying out what God ought to do all day long. And one day I just started laughing when I was on my knees. I said, "I'm sorry, God, I'm trying to con you. That's your job. You know, just help guide me along. Show me what I'm supposed to do is get out of the way." So I started developing that relationship with God. And that really changed a lot over a period of time, because I really didn't trust God at that time. I was willing to take those actions. And I heard a guy say, "You don't have to feel spiritual to be spiritual." And a lot of times I would think I was praying to air, and then I didn't believe any of this stuff, but I kept taking action anyway. And my relationship with God started out as something that I guess I brought with me from my childhood. But really, everybody has a higher power. I've always had a higher power. And I've had my father's higher power, my group, my sponsor, my wife, my business, a bottle of whiskey, you know, a bank account. My higher power is what I lean on to sustain me. And so all those things that are worldly had to just go away at some point in time for me to realize that I got to depend on God. That's the only thing that's the constant. So that's how I built my relationship with God. So I'm going to meetings, and I'm I'm feeling better. I've learned the lingo, and I really like AA, and I'm feeling better. And so Buff keeps telling me, you need to start on this four-step. Well, no, I'm doing just great. Thank you very much. I even said in my home group one night that I thought the promises were coming true for me even though I was on the third step. And I suddenly said that in front of this old guy named Frank Donnelly that was next to me. He said, don't get too well too quick. You're doing the alcoholic waltz. And I said, what's that, Frank? He said, 1, 2, 3, drunk. 1, 2, 3, drunk. And I thought, well, you old goat, what do you know? You know, I've been to treatment. I got this up to date recovery stuff, you know. But, well, I was trying to be a better husband and trying to show up at home. I was trying to, our family was had a lot of turmoil early on, but I thought that was getting better. But I had all this guilt and shame and remorse about cheating on Diane, and I was reading just enough of the book by myself to be dangerous. And it said in there that we made amends and we shared in a general way and we were rigorously honest. And without talking to my sponsor, I went out one night and I got Diane in a conversation, told her in a general way I'd been unfaithful to her. And then I was going to try to be a better husband now that I was sober. And if anybody's thinking about doing that, please come talk to me after the meeting, because I really thought I was doing the right thing. And what it taught me was that I can be really dangerous with this book. There's nothing in this book designed to hurt anybody. And I was really trying to do the best I thought I could do at the time, but I was doing it my way. And I went and told my sponsor, and I tried doing my best to clean up my language up here, so I won't tell you exactly what he told me, but I'll paraphrase it. He said that, you know, that's why they number the steps for smart college boys like you. You're not only a men's step, you ain't even done a four-step. He said, and by the way, Hoss, you didn't make amends to her. All you did was dump your guilt. And when he said that, it's like somebody stuck an ice pick through me, because I knew he was right, and I didn't know that. You know, I don't know why I thought I needed to, that I have to reinvent the wheel with this. This stuff was written down by people a long time ago, and this formula worked. And if I go through it with a sponsor that's already been through the process, he can just walk me through it. I don't have to know anything. I just have to do stuff. There's nothing really to learn. And that's when I got teachable, because I thought Diane was going to leave me, and she didn't. And she had every right to. And that's when I hit my bottom then. And I was going to drink again or blow my brains out or start writing a four-step. And I really got so uncomfortable, I didn't know which one to do. That's a terrible spot to be in. But I started writing, and I wrote these resentments. I wrote all the resentments I had against these people. I wrote what they did to me, how it affected me, those first three columns. I'm thinking, hey, I like this, because I think I'm a people pleaser, and I'll do things for people, and they just, turn against me or use it against me. But then I wrote in that fourth column, what were my mistakes, and what should I have done instead? And when I wrote in that fourth column, I might as well throw away the first three columns, because that's how I lived my life. That's how I treated people in my life. The people I had the most resentments toward were the people that were the closest to me, that loved me the most. And I'm thinking, wow, I got work to do. So I prayed for the people I had resentments for, and I made a fears list. You know, it says we listed our fears in black and white, so I write down all these fears that I had about things. And it was good to write them down, just because before that it was all just bouncing in my head like a weed eater. But I wrote down all these fears, and the book says, we ask ourselves why we had them. So I wrote all these elaborate reasons of why I had all these fears that I'd written down. But that's just a drunk trap, because the next sentence in the book said, wasn't that because self-reliance failed us? And I looked at all my reasons, and I might as well just torn that off and threw it away. You know, I'd gone through life thinking I got to keep my back against the wall, shoot my way out of everything else, and I'm supposed to be this tough guy, bluff people, run over people, do all that. That's a terrible way to live. You know, when I'm sober, I'm full of fear. I need all the help I can get, and it says we ask God to remove our fear and show us what He would have us be. And I didn't have that skill, and that works every time. When I have fear, I say, God, you know, don't help me to tough it out. Take this away. Show me what I'm supposed to do. Then I did a sex inventory, and I might as well have written a story. I could have written one story of how I treated all the women I'd ever been out with, whether it was a one-night stand or a 15-year marriage to Diane at the time. I might as well have written one story how I treated women and just dumped all those names in it because I attracted them the same way. I treated them the same to get what I wanted. You know, look who I'm with. It's all about me and all that stuff. Let me get you whatever you need to get what I want. And I thought, man, I never knew how to be a partner. Nobody ever taught me how to be a partner. And so I'm thinking, man, this marriage I've got is just down the drain. There's no way it'll be fixed. And Buff said, why don't you just keep it taking action and let God sort that out? So I did that sex inventory. I went to his condominium on Saturday morning to do a fish step with him. And he showed me in the book where people that kept secrets to themselves, the first 100 people that got sober, the ones that kept secrets, invariably they got drunk. So I wrote down every secret I didn't want to tell anybody, and I wrote some of it in code in case they'd find a paper they wouldn't know what it meant. And I go in there, and he asked invited God in the room, and he said, "What's the worst thing on your list?" Right off the bat. And so I looked down at the code, and I told him something I never want to tell anybody. And I thought he was going to say, "What an order, I can't go through this, you need to get out of here." But instead, he told me the worst thing that was in his fifth step. He was a guy that loved me enough to tell me the worst thing he'd ever done to make me feel comfortable enough to empty this garbage can that I've been carrying around. So I told him this other stuff. And after a while, he said, "Okay, is that it?" And I looked down at the code, and there was some other stuff on there that was similar to what I'd already told him. And my mind went to work just like that. "Well, you've already told him this other stuff. You don't need to tell him that." So I didn't tell him. And he asked me a couple times, "Is that it?" And I looked down and I said, "Yeah, that's it." So I leave his house and I'm going to go to my office for an hour, like the book says, to review the first 5 steps. And I get about a block away. And I mean, my heart starts pounding because I know I didn't tell him everything. And what really got me was there was a guy who was in my group that couldn't stay sober. And he'd do some step work, then he'd get drunk. And he'd just come to our Monday night meeting a week or so, a couple days before, and said that he'd taken a fifth step and he left some stuff out and had ate his lunch so bad that he drank again and he got another white chip. And for the first time, that's when I realized that if I'm a real alcoholic, I got to do all this stuff you guys do. I don't get to do it cafeteria style. I got to do it all or I'm a dead man. And I picked up my phone, I called Buff, I said, "Look, I got to tell you something, I left something out." And he starts laughing. And I said, I'm thinking, I'm sweating because I don't want to admit to him that I lied to him, one thing, and I didn't want to tell him this stuff. And I said, "Why are you laughing?" He said, "Oh man, usually it takes a couple hours before they call back, you're easy." And he said, "What is it?" And I told him what it was, and he said, "I love you anyway." And I've got to tell a lot of men that. "I love you anyway. We're just trying to get well here." So after I did that, I did steps in 6 and 7. Thought I was entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character and humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. I thought, boom, boom, 2 steps, 2 paragraphs, 5 minutes after all this hard work. And by the way, if you're stuck on a step, the steps aren't punishment. Sometimes when I'm really up against something, an inventory or an amends, it's almost like this stuff's so hard to do. It's not punishment, it's a way to freedom. It's the only freedom I've ever had in my life. Every time I do something after I've put it off for a long time, I look back, I thought, "Man, why didn't I do that sooner?" All it does is prolong the misery and put off my recovery. So I do the 6th and 7th step, and for the next couple months, I don't make this amends list. I think, well, now I've figured out how I've loused up my life. I'm not going to be that guy anymore. I did this inventory. I got the knowledge. And what it was, little by little, I was the same depressive, explosive, sarcastic, angry guy that I always was, except I knew why now. And that's a terrible spot to be in. And I got in a situation where I cussed out my father-in-law and yelled at my kids one day, and I called my sponsor, and he said, "Congratulations, you've been trying to remove your own character defects." He said, "Why don't you get on your knees and say the 7-step prayer like you mean it, and let's get busy on these amends." So I want to tell you about some amends I done. I made a list of all the men, the people I'd harmed, and wrote down the harm, and I just left it blank and gave it to my sponsor. I said, "Please help me with this," because he's been around the block with me. So I want to tell you about my wife first off, because I love her dearly. I love her more every day, and she's my partner, my lover, my best friend. Buff had me write her a letter. He was about 2 years sober at the time, and his best interpretation of the steps, he told me to write her a letter, which I did, and I gave her the letter, and she read it and tore it up right in front of me. And I went back to him, and I said, "Well, that didn't work. What else do we do?" And he showed me in the book where he thought that's all we could do. He said, "You just be the husband, father that you're trying to be." And so I thought, well, I'm going to have to make living amends to this person, to my wife, and things will get better. And things did get better than they were. And I thought that was better than it was. And about 5 and a half years later, we went to a counselor, something to do with our kids, and we weren't in that counselor's office 5 minutes and my infidelity came up. And I got some information from this counselor that I took back to my sponsor, and I found out what Diane wanted for an amends. And my sponsor said, what do you think about that? And I said, well, I don't think that'll work, and I think she'll leave me. And he looked at me and he said, do you think you could stay sober? She did. And I didn't want that because I was really trying to make this marriage work. He said, you know, that's what she needs. And that's when I realized that I have to make amends to people the way they want it, not the way I want to make it. And so I decided to do that. And I met her. She and I got with this counselor, and I told her, I said, I don't think this is going to work, and I love you, but this is what you want. I'm willing to do it. And I made the amends to her, and that was 22 years ago next month. And I've got a marriage today that's built on honesty and trust. It's taken a long time to build that trust again. And some people say, well, I'm not sticking around 5.5 years to make a marriage work. But I'm telling you, the guy standing right here is, I wouldn't trade my marriage with anybody. And I work real hard trying to keep that slate clean, too. I want to tell you about my next-door neighbor, Mr. Logan. You know, Buff said, we don't just go tell people, you don't go tell them how sorry, or they know how sorry you, what a sorry son of a gun you are. He said, you need to go repair the damage if you can. If you're going to cause further harm, you can't do it. And I've got a couple of amends that I can't make, that I'm willing to make, but it would cause harm to other people, so I still can't do it. But he said, well, Mr. Logan, he said, you need to apologize to him, and you need to plant him another weeping cherry tree. Now, you don't need to tell him you know how it died. He doesn't know you killed it. They won't add anything, you know. And I don't know about you guys, but when I get an amend assignment, those people just appear. And a couple days later, I pull in my driveway coming back from the back room group, and I see my neighbor out there on his riding lawnmower. And my heart starts pounding. I stop at the foot of my driveway, and I put my car in park. And I said, God, I don't know exactly what to say here. Give me the right words to say, and give me the courage to do this. And I get out of the car, and I walk around the 6-foot-high wood fence I put up after he sued me to try to screen him out, and I walk over to him, and he sees me coming toward me. And I mean, he's afraid of me. I mean, I could see the whites of his eyes, like, oh no, what do I do? I mean, he had this look like, you know, can I get this lawnmower in a high enough gear to outrun this guy, or should I jump off an abandoned ship and run? And I mean, he didn't want to talk to me. Well, we hadn't spoken in years, but he turned the lawnmower off, and I walk over to him, and I said, Mr. Logan, can I talk to you for a minute? He said, sure, what is it? And I said, I did a terrible thing cutting your trees down. And I've disrespected you and your wife for a long time, and all that was wrong. And I don't know what I can ever do to make up for the damage I've caused you, but if there's anything I can ever do to make that right, I'm willing to do whatever it is. Now, I didn't mean to say that. I didn't mean to say I'll do whatever you want me to do. I really didn't. That was not my plan. But I asked God to direct what came out of my mouth, and that's what I said. And I thought the guy would just say, get off my property and don't you come near me again. Because that's how I dealt with a lot of people, got in my way, get out of my way. And sometimes, you know, we hurt people beyond their capacity to love us sometimes, and they want to be left alone, and that's what you do. And so I would have honored that. And I thought he was just going to say, get away from me and stay away from me. But instead, he came up to me, and he put his arms around me, and he started hugging me, and he started sobbing. This man's 80 years old. And he's hugging me, and he's sobbing on my shoulder, and I'm just frozen. And he held me for a while. And he pulled back away from me, and he looked me right straight in the eyes, and he said, what's in the past is over. He forgave me just like that. And as soon as he did that, I was so shocked by that I thought, okay, he's forgiven you, run. I mean, I'm a fight or flight guy. I mean, I was ready to run away. And if I hadn't had clear instructions from my sponsor about what to do then, that's what I would have done, and I'd miss what I'm going to tell you now, and I could just sit down and my story would be over. If my best thinking was said run. But I had clear instructions from Buff, and I could hear his voice say, don't you run away, you got something to do here. I said, I really appreciate you doing that, but I said, I want to make up for the damage I've caused you. And that's when he looked at me again, and he said, you already have by coming over here. He said, the thing that hurt my wife and I the most all these years is that we've lost our neighbor. And we've been praying every day that we'd get our neighbor back, and now our prayers have been answered. Now, I'd been pulling in my driveway every day cussing him, and he'd been praying for me every day. Terry told me a couple years ago, after he heard me tell his story a bunch of times, he said, you know, if you ever get to where your higher power is not big enough, why don't you just borrow Mr. Logan's for a while? And I said, well, thank you, but I really want to do something, you know, to make up for this. He said, no, you don't have to do anything. I said, well, I noticed your cherry tree died over there. Could I plant you another one? He said, oh, you don't have to do that. And I said, well, I'd like to if you let me. And I didn't have my people anymore. My business had gotten worse after I got sober. It eventually got better, but it got worse because I made a lot of bad decisions. But my son, who was 12 at the time, who doesn't remember doing this, he and I went and got a bigger weeping cherry tree, and we planted it in Mr. Logan's yard. And I got a letter that I carry in my big book that I'd like to read to you that he wrote to me at one point in time. And you know, as I read this, when I was taking actions to the steps the very first time, I was trying to just put out the fires I had in my life. I was taking action on my resentments and my fears and making amends, and I was trying to fix right what was going on there. It never dawned on me that 28 years later, that what I did, those actions I took are still paying me dividends today. You know, he wrote me this letter, and I thought it was nice, but I've got to share this letter with a lot of people, you know. This is dated June 26, 1991. Dear Mike, it was with much surprise that we found a beautiful cherry tree in our yard when we returned home yesterday. We had not expected it so soon. We appreciate it so very much, and we will care for it and cherish it always, not only for its own sake, for it is a beautiful tree, but because it symbolizes a deep and lasting friendship between us and you and your family. We pray that God will bless you and your family in all that you do, and we pray for ourselves, for we are sinful people by nature. There are none of us without fault, and we need His constant love and forgiveness. Again, we thank you for the tree. We're all the more grateful because you did not have to do it. Your friendship means more to us than you know. Most sincerely, George Logan. Now, this man gave us a country ham or a box of steaks every year for Christmas until he died after that. When my father died, the very first flowers that came to the funeral home was a wreath of purple orchids from Mr. Logan. I've still got one of them on my desk. He died several years later, and you guys have taught me to show up for weddings and funerals and graduations, stuff that I used to be too busy for. And when he died, I went to this Baptist church in my neighborhood, a great big church, and it was full of people because he had a lot of friends. And I didn't know a soul in this place, and I'm shaking hands with people in the receiving line, and I shake hands with this one man, and he said, oh, you're Mr. Allison. Dad told us all about you. And I'm going, oh, great. He said that you'd had a disagreement, but that you'd made it right. But you see, the way I used to live, I would have gone to the grave hating that man. It was only because I was desperate enough to take the steps that I got guidance from my sponsor to fix all that. You know, after I started making those amends, I started knowing a new freedom and a new happiness. I really started getting the promises in my life. I had steps 10 to stay current, step 11 to get to know this God and practice these principles in all my affairs, try to give this thing away. And my life's good. You know, I'm in AA, Diane's in Al-Anon, our sons are in Al-Teen, we're in Al-Cat and Al-Dog and everything you can belong to. And we think we're the recovery family. Then I get the call from my son's eighth grade principal saying they'd caught him with some marijuana and he's out of school for a year, come get him right now. And I'm thinking, you don't understand, we're the recovery family. And I was really angry about that. I was really taking credit for my own sobriety. We finally got him in an alternative learning center, and I had to drive him, pick him up every day at between 5 minutes to 2 and 2 o'clock in Nashville. And I had a sod farm on the way on the west side of town, and I'd leave my sod farm sometime after 1 o'clock and drive into Nashville and get him and either drive him to our house in South Nashville and all the way back to the sod farm or bring him back there. And I had to work extra hours because I was away from work for a year. And I thought, is that my reward? You know, I've got contempt prior to investigation really bad about a lot of things. Sometimes I don't see where God's given me a gift when I think it's just a struggle. But what it did, it forced me to spend time with my son that year that I wouldn't have spent with him because I worked all the time. And I got to know him on a level that's just priceless. He's 36 years old now. He lives in Northern California. He's been out there almost 16 years. He hadn't had a drink in almost 8 months now. He's a lot like me. He's going to a little bit AA, and I told him not long ago, I said, look, I want you to know I love you, and you know what AA means to me, but I don't ever want you to think that I think any less of you that you're not going to AA. This is your path. Any way I can be available to you, I love you, and I support you any way I can. But I have a bond with him that I built that year that I had to spend picking him up at school, you know, and I wouldn't have that if I hadn't been forced to do that. Some of you guys said you like my tie. I love Dr. Seuss. I read Dr. Seuss when I was a kid. I read him to my sons, read him to my granddaughter. Really, it's about as intellectual as I get. And my granddaughter gave me this tie. And I want to talk about my granddaughter. Back in May, our granddaughter, who's just been the apple of our eye, she's come to our meetings with us on Friday nights when she was little. And she let us know right before she's going to graduate in May. She said, "I want you to know that I'm wearing a boy's cap and gown, and I'm going to walk as Aiden Allison instead of her other name." She said, I'm transgendered. I've been transgender for several years, and both her parents have treated Aiden as Aiden for several years, but they kept it a secret from us for some reason or other. And so I don't have a granddaughter anymore. I have a grandson now. And that's taken some, it's just different. It's just different. And the pronouns get me all mixed up all the time, and he laughs about it and says, "Don't worry about it." But he's going through the process of being Aiden as a man. And you guys have taught me unconditional love. And I know that a transgender person sometimes feels some anxiety and even some prejudice in society. And I know that he needs my love and support more now than ever before. And so I've told him that I love you and I support you, and I'll do anything I can to help you. And I thank AA for giving me the gift to be proactive on that. We found out a little while ago our other son, who's Aiden's father, is going to move to Lake Tahoe, it looks like. He's been living in Nashville all along, and now he's going to move to Nevada. And so our kids are going to be gone. That's going to be another change we have. But we go through these changes in sobriety together. We share them. We don't keep our private life secret. We live with our armor open in the fellowship. It seems like all the struggles we go through, all any of us have is our stories. And we want to share that if it's a benefit to somebody. And if somebody'd like to know about how I made amends to Diane, I'm willing to share that with you one-on-one. I really enjoyed being here tonight. This is just a wonderful place. And I want to close. There's a Bill Wilson, I get Grapevine quote of the day. You can get that emailed to you for free if you want it. I get it every morning. And this is the Grapevine quote of the day from October 3rd. And Bill Wilson wrote this in 1961. "Let us remember that great legion who still suffer from alcoholism and who are still without hope. Let us, at any cost or sacrifice, so improve our communication with all those that they may find what we have found, a new life of freedom under God." You know, my grand sponsor Don says that, you know, we're the blessed ones. We get to live a second life in the same lifetime. And I really love God, and I love AA. I love you guys, and I love this good life. Thank you very much.